Hi, this is Paul. Monday morning, I posted the commentary on the main body of the conversation between N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray, and I promised that I would do the questions, and I think the questions were quite good. Now, of course, with something like this, Justin Brierley is a whole range of questions in front of him, and Justin has been hosting these kinds of debates and conversations for a very long time. He has a good sense of what the audience wants to hear, and so he's vetting the questions, reformulating the questions, I would assume picking questions that are good examples of many of the questions. And from the questions that he picks, I think he's probably right. So let's jump into it.
Let's put this first question to you first of all, Douglas, and I'll invite you both to be brief if you can, because there's a lot of questions here we'd like to get through. So maybe just a couple of minutes each on each of these. But Dylan asks, Douglas and N.T. Wright agree on the importance of the Christian story, but does it matter if it's not true? Douglas, how about you start on this one?
Well, obviously it matters. It matters a huge amount. There is a complex corner, which I'm obviously at, which is whether you can, whether it is possible, and I'm not dogmatic on this question, but whether it is possible to keep what you need without holding on to the idea of it being true. Now, of course, what we mean by true in this context is very complex. Let's just park that for the moment.
And I'm not going to park it because that's a real question. Now, if you've been following my channel, I've been making the argument that what story does, narrative does, is it's this massive compression engine to try to figure out a world that is too big for us to manage or engage. And so story is actually the way we do this. And this is where Jordan Peterson comes along and says, there are ways in which fiction is more true than, let's say, individual accounts of physical happenings. Let's phrase it that way. And so in modernity, someone would ask a question like this because they want to say, well, there needs to be a one-to-one correspondence somehow between language and a physical event. But now again, you've got the problem. Those of you who've been following along with my videos, even an event is a product of a complex mapping of the world when we differentiate it from, let's say, I'm sitting on this corner in Sacramento, California. There's a busy intersection right outside my door. Car accidents are regular things. And I'll sit in my office. You'll hear someone hitting brakes. You'll hear a crash. And then everything goes quiet. That's an event. All right. What is the event? Well, the event, the different drivers and passengers, that event impacts them. And there is a physical collision in history that happens. But the story of this event, well, that's built on whole masses of things. I'm not saying this to get out of it, because the event and the physicality and the actuality of the event are vital to the importance that we have. So let's say the people all go to court and one of them says the accident never happened. Well, what do they mean? There was never a physical collision. And then now all of these other witnesses can be brought in and says, hey, I saw the cars collide. I saw the radiator fluid out on the pavement. I saw the broken pieces of glass and plastic. I saw the person bleeding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So physicality matters. But what this question really never pays much attention to is, what is the relationship between the story and the physicality? And again, those of you who have been following my channel for a long time know I get into this a lot. Now, actually, I wasn't terribly impressed with Tom Wright's answer to this in this video. A few days after this event, they'd have the big conversation where Tom Wright would talk to Tom Holland. And actually, I think his answer in that video was better than this one. Now, I assume that at some point Justin is going to release these conversations, and then when he does, I'll definitely like to do a commentary on those too.
I think there is an enormous temptation which sits at the moment. It's many people have written about it. I mean, the person I think of most clearly is Schopenhauer in the Dialogue on Religion, who writes in a fascinating way about the possibility that it is, as it were, the philosophy for the masses. I think this is a temptation to follow this idea. I also think, obviously, for any believer, it's a great error, because it's the whole thing is a form of shadow play. And I think myself that the answer isn't clear. How could it be, perhaps? But the question that I think it was the German jurist Bockenforder who put the dilemma out, I first came across this in the writings of Ratzinger, Pope Benedict. Bockenforder's dilemma is, can we maintain an ethical and more structure without the roots that gave it birth? And many people think that the conclusion is already in on that, and that the answer is no. I don't know, because I think that we're currently living through an attempt at that experiment. It's like the question of, you know, exactly where the fire stops and where the heat begins, and when you know where you're living in the embers, and whether you know whether you can get them going again. It's exceptionally hard to know, because you're living through it.
Yeah.
Tom, do you...
That's an interesting answer. And again, as with Tom Holland, in the case of Douglas Murray... Take a drink. In the case of Douglas Murray and Tom Holland, we have two individuals who are... generally make skeptical noises about the physicality of certain claims within the Christian church and the Christian tradition, yet are seeing the, or are anxious about the consequences of large numbers of people pushing these narratives out of their lives and no longer practicing it. Now, I just finished a video. Now that I've mentioned it, I should probably post that video before I post this one. A Sunday Leftover video where, as I continue to try to piece this thing together, the nexus between history, physicality, consequences, are deep in this conversation. And that's why, on one hand, you should nuance the question, does it really happen? Well, what exactly are you asking? Because if you were to ask a question like, is my wife true? Now, that doesn't live divorced from a physical world in, let's say it was a man who was concerned that his wife was cheating on him. Cheating on their marriage, sleeping with other men. Is your wife true? Does it question whether or not she's sleeping with other men? Well, that certainly is involved. Is your wife true? Now, let's say you can imagine a story in which she is sleeping with other men in order to, and the movies and stories are full of this, in order to protect my life. Let's say someone is holding her blackmail, and he says, if you don't sleep with me, I'll kill your husband. And you're not to tell him about it, or I'll kill him. And so my wife sleeps with other men in order to save my life. Is she true? On one hand, you would say no, because she's committing adultery. On the other hand, you would say yes, because what she's actually got in mind is my own future happiness and well-being. And she's in a ghastly bind that we can imagine a story of. It's not unimaginable. A ghastly bind in which, yes, she is indeed true. And you get, you know, was the wife of Odysseus true? And so we're dealing with this kind of thing, and so in some ways, what we're standing atop of are hundreds of years in which we have to ask the question, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ true? And see, now the problem is I already watched that conversation with Tom Holland and Tom Wright, and I really like what Tom Wright had to say in terms of the video camera question, and so I'll deal with that when we get there. But these are the kinds of dilemmas that are in here. And again, I am not a skeptic of the physical resurrection of Jesus. But Douglas Murray might be. But what he's most anxious about is what many of us are most anxious about, this communal society in which codes of conduct seem to be constructed on ancient ideas, such as human rights, is a product of Christian history. Can you remove the history and still have the benefits of human rights?
You would expect me probably to quote St. Paul, if the Messiah is not raised, your faith is futile and we're still in our sins. You know, it's pretty basic. That there is stuff that happened that was unexpected, that was dramatic, that you couldn't actually have made up. Anyone 30 years, 60 years later than Jesus wouldn't have made it up like that. We know a lot about the sort of stories that they lived on. And this.
Now, this argument that Tom Wright is making is his central argument, that you can find short versions of it on the internet. You can find an expanded version of it in his massive book, The Resurrection of the Son of God.
This kind of breaks the boundaries. That doesn't in itself mean that it's true, but it does mean that if you put that in the middle, you can see how everything else makes the sense it makes around it. I mean, I was just thinking as Douglas was talking, saying, could we have all the benefits, as it were, without it being true? It's rather like saying all the things that I most value about having been married for nearly 50 years now, supposing my wife didn't exist, but I could still have a lovely home and well-cooked meals, et cetera, would that be all right? And the answer is, of course not, because it's all about her and being with her and together with her. And Christianity is all about Jesus. It isn't Jesus so that we can have something else, a nice system of how to live. It's we have Jesus, and because we have Jesus, then all the other things make sense. So if you take Jesus away, and that means Jesus being crucified and raised from the dead, then I'm sorry, it's just not going to work. Theologians and others have tried to do without the resurrection in the last century, and their systems basically fail, in my view. And the churches that follow those, I think, have often proved that point as well. So, yeah, nice try, no cigar would be my sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a perfectly reasonable answer, but I don't tend to find it convincing. I don't find others find it convincing, I'll say it that way. It's a perfectly reasonable answer, but yeah.
Yes, but this is the bit where you end up feeling embarrassed in front of Christopher Hitchens, isn't it? If you're required to believe in these things like miracles, and specifically the core miracle at the heart of Christianity,
and it's always interesting if we just pause those, slow those sentences down, and say required to believe. Okay, required to believe in terms of what sense? In order for it to work with me, well, what goes into that? It's these little relational consequential connections of this is if Jesus walked out of the grave, you know, I often boil it down to if you live like Jesus, you'll die like Jesus, you'll be raised like Jesus, you'll reign with Jesus. That's in some ways the heart of the Christian message. And if it didn't happen, which means that if Jesus was a failed revolutionary, the strangest revolution of all, because it had no chance of a really hapless revolutionary who was crucified and said all of these lovely things from the cross, and then people later would say, oh, what lovely things, but it doesn't work. Well, what do we mean work? We mean somehow provide for blessedness. But again, this is where Tom Holland's arguments about blessedness. Well, the blessed, and Jordan Peterson's, the blessedness we enjoy in Western civilization work because of ancient belief in the blessedness. And if we sort of break the chain, but not just ancient belief in the blessedness, but the kinds of ancient sacrificial service that those who believed in the blessedness did, the ones who stayed in the plague-ridden cities to care for their pox-covered neighbors and died because of it, and that moral witness inspired those who survived the plague to, in fact, live like those who cared for them. This chain of irrational generosity that believes in the life of an age to come, once you sort of burst the bubble of the life of the age to come, well, there's no point in staying in the pox-filled pandemic city when I can have my best life now out somewhere else. You know, let them die in their pox-filled way. None of us want to live in the world that way. And so we esteem, and again, Tom Holland makes this point, we esteem that way because we think that's the way it should be. Well, once we're using that language should, we're already on the path to believing, well, that's the way it should be, but alas, the world doesn't work that way, so eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But again, we're stuck in that trap. We don't want to live in that world.
No, well, here's another question, and see what you think of this, Douglas. Bensonium asks, when it comes to Douglas losing his faith, was it those intellectual difficulties in miracles, the virgin birth, or something else? And I suppose I could ask about the resurrection as well. I mean, Tom obviously feels if Christianity is ultimately going to be helpful, it's helpful on the basis that something really happened that changes the world, changes people, and then works out from there. I mean,
yes.
What's your take on that if you're not really sure that you can go down that resurrection route?
Well, let me just argue something slightly counter to what I just said, but doesn't completely counter it, but it might complement it. I remember some years ago reading a very interesting a book by George Steiner in which he relayed a conversation he said was one of the most important conversations he had in his life, which was actually in South Africa, which Tom just referred to. I hope I don't get it wrong. It's in one of his later books, but Steiner says that late one night over dinner, he's talking with some activists, happen to be black activists, and I suppose this must have been still in apartheid time. And one of them says to him suddenly, to Steiner, who's obviously Jewish, but you don't understand, we don't have a book. And Steiner said it was one of the most flooring and distressing things he had ever heard. We don't have a book. Now, obviously, these people were not Christian. But what they noticed was they did not have a thing to draw upon in the same way that, for instance, Steiner, although he wasn't exactly a believing a Jew, I think, had the Torah. There's a similar point made by Alan Bloom in one of his books in the 1980s, I can't remember which one, where he says, if you're not going to have the Bible, you would need to have a book of equivalent seriousness to base it all on. And I've always thought this is a very important challenge. Because there are books that people might put forward to try to base it on, but they are never of equivalent seriousness. And it's actually quite hard to think of a book of equivalent seriousness to the Bible. But so I do think this is a challenge. What would you base it all on?
Exactly.
That's a powerful point. So this is the third time I've listened to this, and I was explaining to someone, part of the reason I do this is because it forces me to slow down, listen much more carefully to their answers, and weigh them again. And so if you look at my commentary on Jonathan Peugeot and Richard Rowland's conversation about universal history, gosh, this stuff gets so complex very quickly. In order for us to live together productively, we need to have a common story. This morning, I just finished listening to Tom Holland's The Rest is History podcast on the Aztecs. And it's going to send me down the Aztec route here. But the a common story unites a society together. And what that story, what that book yields in society, what, and not just what the story in the book yields in society, but the value. I just talked to Sevilla King last week. The value and the shared assumption, again, back to Jordan Peterson's first biblical series, how we act it out is deeply programmed by these books and by these stories. And this is what we value as being good and true. And apart from that, what do you have? And you can in some ways see the entire history of human civilization as slowly, painfully building up, watching, learning again and again in order to understand what can yield a better life. And these get played out in very broad terms over very long centuries. You know, none of us are long-lived enough or smart enough to do this on our own. We always do it from within stories. And we're not even sure what elements of those stories grab us or why we find it compelling or how they work. But this is what we do.
And it's fascinating because A.C. Grayling, maybe 10 years ago, produced that thing called The Good Book, which was his attempt to do a sort of secular Bible, and it fell flat on its face.
Yeah.
It was a very shallow and rather distressing production. But the Christian, the point of the Christian Bible is, yes, it's a book which does this, that, and the other. It's a great story, but the Christian Bible, the climax of the story is, of course, Jesus. The four Gospels bring the story of Israel to an unexpected and very shocking climax, as a result of which all sorts of other things happen. So it isn't that the Bible is just full of abstract teachings and ethics, etc., and, oh yeah, we've got this book which tells us what to do. It's a story, and you're invited to get on board with the story and to be part of the onward movement that takes it forward from there. And in a sense, the Jewish Bible does the same thing, but in a much more wistful way, because it's telling a story, but the story sort of, well, does it peter out or does it turn into something abstract? That's a question which Jews wrestle with to this day. But the Christian Bible has that climax on Jesus. And if you take that away, well, it's a lovely idea, but why should we credit it?
And again, the world is full of lovely ideas and lovely stories, and we're living in a time of enormous proliferation of stories. More books are being written today than ever before. More narratives are being concocted for movies and television shows than ever before. We're living in an absolute proliferation of stories, and this is where you get back to the Peterson and Peugeot conversations where, well, these stories aren't disconnected, and these stories are derivative, and these stories are being put together from other stories. And of course, Peugeot, the apostle of purpose, would say, well, these stories are not arbitrary. And Peterson would wade in and say, well, psychologically, these stories are not arbitrary, and they play on us in certain predictable ways. And Tom Holland would say, well, these stories all have a legacy, and they all come down to Christianity. And so in many ways, the question is, can you tell a better story, and how will you know whether or not a story is better? Well, we sort of crowdsource our knowledge, and we wait and see whether these other stories will in fact gain traction and outperform. And at this point, haven't seen one.
Yeah, I mean, Douglas, just coming back on that, and there's a question that maps ties into this a bit from Alex, who asks, you, Douglas, would you consider yourself a moral realist? I suppose the question I want to ask along with that is, do you consider there is a story that we're supposed to be living by? I.e., is there something that transcends us? Is there a purpose? Is there a morality? Is there a something to which we are beholden? Because in a sense, that...
And again, I just finished that video on my Sunday leftovers on Psalm 1, because in Psalm 1... Blessed is the man, blessed is the one who doesn't follow the counsel of the wicked or live his life on the road of the sinner, or assemble in the group of mockers, but the one who delights in the law of the Lord. How does that fit into this? And then I get into that in the video. Well, that law is very karmic in a way. Do good things happen. Do bad things happen. It's a beatitude. And of course, this in some ways gets treated by Job. And then when Jesus has these beatitudes on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus' beatitudes are so strange. They're so inverted. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Well, the meek don't inherit the earth. The meek get the short end of the stick, as Steve Martin says in Leap of Faith. So how do these things pan out? And people decide often whether or not to be involved in religion because they discover that, well, even if I take lying off the table, my life still goes better. What do you mean goes better? It's these summary things that are the dead reckoning that we navigate by. And we're constantly trying to figure these things out.
That idea has gone away in a postmodern world, yes. in a new atheist world. You know,
it,
life is whatever you make it. There really is no overarching purpose, no meta-narrative. No. Christianity obviously gave people that and continues to give many people that. A story, as Tom says, to live into, but we don't seem to have those kinds of stories anymore. So where do you find yourself, and are you worried at the lack of this kind of a story now?
Well, I've said before, I can't remember where, that I am, we're clearly, as I think has been mentioned, we're meaning-seeking beings, we're storytelling beings. That having been agreed, the question then is, are we just meaning-seeking beings, or are we meaning-seeking beings and there's meaning? Now, I happen to incline more to the latter position. I don't know exactly what it is, but my inclination goes that way, and it's partly because I think that, and I don't want to get too abstract here, but there are things that you can read even in non-religious texts, which strike you as true. I was reading Brothers Karamazov recently, and
now remember, we started out with the question: is it true? You just used that word again. What does he mean by that? It strikes you as true. Well, it corresponds with what? Well, with everything. It corresponds with physicality. It corresponds to the picture. It corresponds to how these things work. And so that, you know, that word is tricky because we use it in different ways. Because in the first sense, it was used in a very narrow way in terms of a correspondence between a tale of events and a physical reality that can be located here in time. And now, is it true? And we used it in that way. It's much more, is my wife true? Is my father true? Is my son true?
Of course, Dostoevsky's seeped in Christian religion, but there are two moments at least in that book where you gasp, because what Dostoevsky is doing is suddenly taking the story into an entirely other realm. You'll know if you read it that there's a moment when you realize that one of the characters believes he is being visited by the devil. And the moment at which he says to his brother, "How did you know he visits me?" is unbelievably powerful. It knocked me over when I read it, because Dostoevsky is doing something that it seems to me is accurate in our understanding of our lives, which is that we go through them, we act in them as if that is all, and we stumble at strange moments on things that suggest to us that it's not all. And this is an
act that it's all what? We should listen to that again.
Intimation of us is all we accurate in our understanding of our lives, which is that we go through them, we act in them, as if
Okay, so our lives. So that's there's sort of a mental picture of what our life is, and we have that. That's how we navigate.
If as if that is all, and we
as if that is all. What does he mean by that? As if that is. It's just this little acting through things physically down here.
Stumble at strange moments on things that suggest to us that it's not all.
And something happens that we think, we get a vision of that, okay, it's just what I do now and here, and it doesn't matter, and it's all. And I think that that sentence is sort of haunted by the meaning crisis, that, well, what I do here matters for all kinds of things down the road, successive generations. Again, the problem with doing, spending an afternoon here in front of the camera is that one video bleeds into the next because it's all coming out of the same head.
And this is an intimation. I say that, I mean, this is why aesthetics is important to me. It's why music is important to me, why poetry and art is important to me, because I don't think it's doing something just on its own. I think it's giving us a sign of something. I think that it's what's so extraordinarily important about music is that music tells us something that exists in the language we cannot completely speak, but which we know is inviting us towards something which we understand to be true.
It's very C.S. Lewis. Now, again, the Freedom From Religion people who I sometimes put up their little sign here, you know, I know wonder. And in a sense, what wonder says is that's an experience that I have that I find fulfilling. I think about Sam Harris talking to Brett Weinstein about, you know, it's life is this movie we're watching. It's all determined, but we can enjoy the movie, but it's always just a movie. And everyone who dresses up to go see a Star Wars movie or lives into it, they said, no, I want it to be more than a movie. Well, what exactly do you want it to be? And in a sense, the atheist comes in and says, nope, it's just that. Sorry. You know, it's the guy, which never happens, by the way. People know not to do this. You show up at the funeral and you're looking at the box. You're looking at the hole in the ground. Well, that's over. Let's go on. No, I just got a phone call from the mother of a woman who used to go to this church. I talked about this couple in a previous video where they were married in this church and I married them, and he died, wrote the big DNR on his chest, and his widow was just killed in an automobile accident. And the mother of the widow finally got in touch with me and said, I want to try to do some kind of thing for my daughter. I don't know how because of COVID. I don't know where. And I said, well, we'll do it outside here and I'll officiate. And, you know, I don't have, you know, maybe in past decades I could lean on a church that was full of people who could bring food. I don't have that anymore. I just don't worry about the food and the hands. I've got plenty of hands and people will bring food and we'll be okay. So, okay, well, we'll do it outside. We'll do it next month. And, well, why should we pause and all tell stories about this woman's life? Why is that meaningful for her two teenage sons who have now lost their mother? Why is that meaningful for this widow's mother who she's not going to sit until she can do something for her daughter? The atheist comes, oh, daughter's just in the ground. What is her? Your daughter doesn't care. No, because my daughter's life means something. It means something to her sons. It means something to her friends. It means something to her family. Well, what's that something that it means? It has a value that is larger that we will use other things that we value, our money and our time. And, you know, we will, and there'll be plenty of people there. I know she was up and down in terms of what did she believe, her faith. You know, as a pastor, part of the reason I do this on the internet is because when I look on mass media, there's so much that just isn't true about people. People have doubts. They go up and down. They'll, you know, you hear, here's Douglas Murray, that's sort of an atheist. And he says, but when I listen to music, and that's what Jordan Peterson says too, you know, when I listen to music, and Yeah, you can be the smart 12-year-old that says it's just in your head. It means nothing. Well, I like to push and say, okay, what might it mean? Maybe it means that the death is not the end. And just a pastor in a Reformed Church of America church on Twitter was making the comment that, you know, he's talking about the resurrection and people are like, well, that resurrection thing, I don't know. It's just like go to heaven when we die. And I told him, I said, it's a good sign that they're challenging you because it actually shows that you're communicating and they're thinking, because that is common among people here. C.S. Lewis again and again in Miracles says the story of the resurrection doesn't just say we go on after we're dead. There's lots of cultures that do that. It says a lot more, and it says bigger things. So we as human beings are haunted by these questions. And again, as Rafe Kelly said, sort of my inverted Pascal's wager. Okay, if there is nothing past the grave, why don't you not be a jerk at the funeral and let the people mourn? Because why not believe? Oh, because religion, oh yeah, what Douglas Murray does here is just astounding on that, because religion was how people made it through the world. What are you going to do? Use now drugs and video games? That's an improvement. You don't build anything or leave anything behind that way.
I could go on all day about this, but yes, that's my. In short,
it sounds very similar to what you've been talking about in your latest book, Broken Signpost, Tom. That all of these things that speak somehow to our soul are a, as you say, broken signpost towards something beyond them.
Yes, that the language of beauty, and for me, music particularly, is enormously powerful, and it's pointing towards something, but then the music stops, or the sunset fades, or the beautiful friend is killed in a car crash or whatever, and it looks as though then we're back with Jean-Paul Sartre and say life is just a sick joke. And that's where so much of our culture has been. Yeah, it was nice stuff, but it doesn't actually mean anything. And for me, it's only, again, cracked record coming up, it's only when you put the story of Jesus in the middle of that and discover that Jesus and his crucifixion are the kind of ultimate broken signpost, because that's where we see justice denied, beauty trampled on, freedom obliterated, etc. All those things which were our great dreams, which we have lost, are actually true of the story of Jesus going to the cross. And I would urge anyone to reread the story of Jesus going to the cross, thinking of it like that, not just then this happened, then that happened, but those great things that we love, beauty, freedom, spirituality, all of these great ennobling things, they're all there in that story. And Jesus himself, as God incarnate, comes to the place where our dreams let us down, in order to be there with us and then to do the new creation thing out the other side. That's a summary of a much more complicated argument, but that's where it's going.
By the way, so there's one other point worth throwing out there, which is that there is another signpost, as it were, which is that it is actually exceptionally hard to live as a nihilist.
To live as a nihilist. A nihilist, yes.
It's a very interesting thing. Nihilism is spoken about a lot. People quite often describe particular ages as being nihilistic. But in fact, it is very rare to come across an actual nihilist.
Yes.
It almost...
Or someone who actually dare live like one. They're out there. I've met some, but other people don't often like them very much. They don't want to be around them. They find them offensive and obnoxious. And given how people are, I would say it's probably not a very nice way to live. Oh, okay, you've got your pride and your nihilism. Good for you. Everybody thinks you're a jerk. Go live on the edge of the community and people will ignore you and not want to be with you. Doesn't work for human beings very well.
Nobody lives in that state. I can think of probably only one person who pretty much approximates it, which is Michael Welbeck, the French novelist, who certainly writes as a nihilist. But even he, you get the sense, and sorry, Justin, if I've said this before, I can't remember, okay, you get the sense is not completely capable of living as a nihilist either. If I'm giving a quick example, there's an extraordinarily disturbing, sorry, I know we said we'd do 2 minutes with each question.
It's fine. Go ahead.
There's an extraordinary moment in a book by one of the surviving journalists from the Charlie Hebdo offices, who wrote a book called Disturbance a couple of years ago, a very, very upsetting book. But he described bumping into Mikhail Welbeck at a party after some time after the massacre. And he recognizes him, and Mikhail Welbeck had never met him before. They both got bodyguards at this party. And Welbeck sees the still very, very visibly wounded journalist come in, and they stand opposite each other for a moment in this terrible moment of recognition. And Mikhail Welbeck quotes, I believe it's the Gospel of St. Matthew, he says in French to the journalist, he says, men of violence take it by force.
If you go back to my first video, the first commentary on this, I noted, this is the same text that Tom Wright argues from. This is a very unusual text. This text, you'll... preachers avoid this text because this text is notoriously difficult to understand. Now Tom Wright says this text means that everyone's trying to get, Jesus is saying everybody is trying to get in on the revolutionary thing, and now violent men grab hold of it. Now that sort of violent grabbing hold is, boy, this is another one of these ideas that it just is, that I'm just dealing with, is in a sense a very satanic manner, okay? And Jesus is basically saying, yeah, they're all trying to get in on this, but, you know, it's, Jesus is the one who comes through. Human history is littered. The commonality in human history is violent people laying hold of their enemies and killing them in order to secure power and well-being and get what they want. That is the norm in human history. Jesus breaks that norm. Now you see inklings of that in David. So David, twice, and you've got the story of Abigail and Nabal in the middle, 23, 24, 25, if I remember correctly. Or 24, 25, just anyway, 1 Samuel. And David has the opportunity to kill Saul, once when Saul is in a cave relieving himself, another time when Saul is sleeping. And David's trusted men around here is like, the Lord has, you know, nice godly justification. The Lord has given him into your hands. And David says, I will not touch the Lord's anointed. If I'm going to be king, it will be, again, this is where, this is the other thing that's sort of rattling around in my head right now. The Lord, through events in history, will make it happen. I don't need to force it. I don't need to get blood on my hands. This is sort of the counterpoint to the general rule of history. Grab power by violence, turn the world, make the world right by violence. And Jesus says, no, I won't. Kill me first. Go ahead, be violent against me. I will still win.
And then leaves. The journalist, he says, men of violence take it by force. And then leaves. It suggests to me that in Welbeck's head, it isn't entirely nihilism either.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm, yeah, that even then, and who knows where that came from, a bit of memory of French Catholicism or whatever, phrases that did actually give meaning. Yes. And that's a Jesus phrase. Yeah. It's like my favorite novel by the Jewish novelist Chaim Potok is My Name is Asher Lev, where the young rabbinic student who discovers he's got an amazing gift for painting, which is not something that his rabbinic community wants to know about at all, is trying to find models for the pain of being a Jew in the modern world. And he travels from New York to Europe, and he goes around the galleries, and he comes back and he paints crucifixions. And obviously there's a lot of kind of Chagall and so on in the background of that. But part of the grasp of that is a sense of, even in an ultra-Orthodox community where the idea of a cross on the corner outside a church in a street somewhere would mean those are the people who think that we're God killers or whatever. So there's a real fear. Nevertheless, nothing but the crucifixion would do to express what he needed to express. And it's almost as though it's now woven in not just to culture, but the way that the human race is, that at the very moment when it tries to get away from all that traditional Christianity stuff, the best model with which to do it turns out to be something pretty central to what the Christian gospel was all about.
I've got an interesting question here from Carla. We'll start with you, Tom, as she asks this specifically of you. In a postmodern world, are you concerned that our use of the word story has a worldview confusion with myth instead of truth? In postmodernism, everything is story slash myth. Do we need to distinguish Christian truth from story slash myth? What do you say?
Yeah, this is obviously a much more complicated thing than we got time to address, because there's at least four or five different senses of the word myth which have been out there. In the popular discourse, it just means a story about something which we know didn't happen. That's a very low grade meaning of myth, so we can park that. But I would say it's one of the strengths of postmodernity that it has highlighted the ineradicable nature of story within human life. So, there was a kind of a modernist rationalism which imagined.
Now, pay attention. Bishop Barron makes this point. Tim Keller makes this point. A lot of these individuals of, now Bishop Barron's a little bit younger, but 10 years ago, James K. A. Smith makes this point. 10 years ago, many Christian leaders saw postmodernity coming and made exactly this point. And now it is, in a sense, many of the modernists that fear the loss of modernism that come up and, you know, against postmodernity, though they're using the word in a different way to a degree, but notice how, you know, Christians have for a while been saying, well, yeah, it's a recognition of something that we've known that modernity has sort of dismissed.
You could reduce everything to propositions, and that stories were just kids' stuff to entertain the masses while the real philosophers got on with the hard-edged propositions.
Which was basically what Sam Harris said to Jordan Peterson in their conversations.
And I think we now all know, and this is one of the good things about postmodernity, that yes, we live on stories, but the fact that it is a story then does raise the question, but did it happen? It's the question which comes up in a court of law the whole time. It's no good standing there as a witness and saying, let me tell you a story, once upon a time, da-da-da-da, because the judge wants to know and the jury wants to know, but did it happen? And you can rank stories according to the apparent intention of the storyteller. Is this a story which was designed? I mean, take Jesus' parables. It makes no sense to say of the parable of the prodigal son, but what was the father's name? Or what did the mother say when they came back? Or which bit of the farm did he then own? That misses the point as a matter of genre. But if you take Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, actually, it would miss the point of those stories to say, oh, they were just spinning these fantasy narratives like sort of Pilgrim's Progress or something out of thin air. No, Luke is very particular about this. Let me give you the dates. It was in the reign of so-and-so, and so-and-so was the high priest, and this, that, and the other. This is stuff that happened. And the point is, the happenedness of it has changed the world. And I'm back to something Douglas said.
The happenedness of it has, the story has changed the world as much as the happenedness of it. And they go together. That's his point. But it's both and.
Half an hour ago, we have sold ourselves short in Western Christianity because we don't know the true story of church history and all the great stuff that has happened. And we have believed the Enlightenment lie that Christianity was just part of the problem rather than part of the solution all along. That's a whole other topic. But so I want to say, yes, beware of story collapsing into myth. Know what the different kinds of stories are and how they work.
I mean, we don't have time to pursue it, Douglas, today, but maybe another conversation to have at some point would be the fact that I think part of your deconversion, for want of a better word, was to do with coming to doubt the reliability of the Bible and whether it was actually based on historical facts. And obviously,
and reliability is such an interesting word in there, because he didn't say the physical correspondence of the Bible, because reliability is, I mean, it's the right word, but it's all about, well, is this story something that I can rely on? Which again gets back to the question, well, is your wife true? Well, how far does that true go? Has she taken money out of your bank account? Well, to buy groceries for the family. Oh, okay. Well, then she's true. She's taken money out of the bank account to run away with her lover to Madagascar. No, then she's not true. What exactly are we talking about in terms of true here? How does this work?
The miraculous nature of it as well. But do you feel like if you could be shown sort of the factuality of it, as well as the way it makes sense of our culture and everything else, that would...
Justin, you're such an evangelist.
I guess be the missing piece for you that would take you back.
See, and so I get to this point and say, okay, what do you want from Douglas Murray? You want him to go to church every week? Okay. How about the gay thing? You want him to, like, I don't know if he's married to a man or what his situation is. Is that what you want? You want him to stop? Okay. Why? What for? In terms of your little narrative to validate you? Would you be happy if he went to a church that had a rainbow flag and said, "Well, he's fine the way he is. We're not gonna talk about that." Would that satisfy you? Because you have the sense that, well, okay, first align with us, and then okay, and then we're gonna want you to. Well, why? Well, because it validates me. Okay. Well, all of this gets at the question. Okay, what is the good that we're getting at? What is the good that we want in people? What is the good we want for people? So, you know, again, I think these questions deserve more pause and pursuing as well.
In some sense, maybe even to a new kind of faith.
It's too complex to say what the missing piece would be or could be, and it would be presumptuous of me to try to explain it or suggest it, let alone know it.
So there, Justin.
Actually,
you pesky evangelist.
I would just duck that by making an observation on one thing that just came up, which is of all the different understandings of myth, even the least deep understanding of myth, it still irritates me when you hear the phrase "only a myth."
Exactly.
An extraordinarily facile phrase, exactly. Which is in far too common a use. The metamorphoses of Ovid are not history. They're not only a story.
Yeah. But this was the point that grasped C.S. Lewis, wasn't it? That he had thought that all this stuff was just myth, and then he turned a corner and realized, oh my goodness, looks like this great myth actually happened once.
Yes.
The dying and rising Corn King or whatever it was.
Now, and this, okay, well, let's go back to Jordan Peterson's words to Bishop Barron on this. And, okay, well, okay, Douglas, what would bring you to leave your, let's say, your husband? Even if you decided that, this is where I like what Jordan Peterson said to Bishop Barron, because in a sense the question is, what myth, what story, what vision, what we don't even know what to call it, what of sufficient power would compel you to maybe even forsake sexual license? Or maybe it would be, on one hand, you would say, I don't know that my same-sex attraction is necessarily a good thing, but yet I've made promises to this man that I ought to keep. And so I will not leave him. And you know, what we do in terms of, you know, our bodies and each other, that will be between us. So get away from me, you pesky Christian. But you know, the point of it is what inspiration, what thing would inspire you to make the kinds of sacrifices? And I'll just pull, you know, my friend's book, you know, which was, you know, I got a blurb on the back, but what would send you to India to decide that even if this God who wasn't giving you any personal spiritual moments of meaning and rapture send you out onto the streets of India to at least provide a little bit of physical comfort to dying people. There's something that draws us to say, I'm going to sacrifice what comes naturally to me, the selfish way it's natural for me to live my life, in order to pursue something. And that something being what most of us look around and say, well, yeah, if you wanted to go to Africa and help dying people at the risk of your own life, that would be a very inspirational thing. And again, even this is where Tom Holland comes in again, because, well, why would that be inspirational? Well, because there's a story back there. And now for so long, we as a community have made that so real to say that's a powerful story, and it's a story that's inspiring. And again, I know plenty of people who look at these stories and, okay, so their child is going to go off to Africa and be a missionary, and the parents are like, yeah, I respect them for it, but be careful, please, because if something were to happen to you, I don't know what. But mom, dad, because of Christ, I'm going to do this. It's at that level that these stories really grab us, and that's what we're looking at. And so it's not just a matter of, oh, okay, I think Jesus rose out of the grave, so I'm going to start going to church now. It's more than that. It's I see something in Christianity that is so compelling. I'm going to deny myself, take up my cross, and follow him. And again, all that's terribly mythic language. It's terribly abstract, and people use it all the time. And I don't find a lot of Christians walking down the streets of Sacramento dragging wood that they've picked up at Home Depot. It's, again, language, myth, what's going on? What you find is people caring for others at tremendous cost to themselves, because of the love of Christ. It's that story of Mabel that you can find on my blog. Gosh, I kind of want to read it now, because it's just such a good story, and it breaks me up every time I read it. And every time I read it, my faith grows, and it grows because it's such a good story and because it really happened. No, I won't read it right now, because... yeah, I read plenty of those stories, the Corrie ten Boom story, the Mabel story. They're all over the place. And it's something that inspires us to deny ourselves and to love each other in such radical ways. And people say, well, what justifies this? And we're not exactly sure, are we? I mean, soldiers do the same things. People do the same things in lots of different ways, but it all sort of coalesces in this story.
Mm. And made that discovery in the company of a great storyteller himself, J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course.
Tolkien, yes. Yes.
And in that sense, there is this idea that these great myth stories, you know, they are, you know, Lord of the Rings is arguably drenched in a kind of Christological overtones, and that these are the stories that seem to compel us and grab us and so on. And in that sense, as time is drawing to a close, Douglas, I suppose, you know, you've been so very gracious, because a lot of these have been very personal sort of questions.
But I'm going to turn it one more time on you, Doug.
About faith and that kind of thing. But do you wish...
Here it comes, Doug. Brace yourself.
For it to be true, do you wish that there was, that, as Lewis said, this is the true myth? Is that something that you could see making sense of the world if there was a true story?
Please, Doug, please
story that everything sort of came
of course. I mean, I don't really understand people who don't wish it to be true. I don't really understand those people. I do have known some. We mentioned one earlier who don't wish it to be true, didn't wish it to be true. No, of course I do. I suppose that one thing that I've always found extremely powerful in that regard is whenever I've been in the Holy Land, Israel, surrounding area. I never forget one of the first times I was there, I think during the 2006 conflict in Lebanon. And I was speaking to, I happened to stop one day, and there was a church that was being built. And it's quite unusual to need a new church in that neck of the woods. But one was being built for various reasons. And I asked the person who was in charge that day, I said, by the way, what's the name of the church? And he said, it's the Church of the Transfiguration. And I said, beautiful, how did you decide to do that? And he said, well here we name churches after the nearest site, and the Transfiguration happened there. And he pointed to the mountain beside us. And wherever in the world you're brought up as a Christian, it makes an enormous impact on when you see the physical sites. I've traveled around there a lot, and I don't think for me anything quite equals that in terms of making an impact on me. But I think, you know, what we aren't transparent to ourselves, and I'm not transparent to myself, and I have no idea how to answer that question.
Well, you've answered a great many questions very helpfully and as honestly as you can, Douglas. Thank you very much for the time this evening. Thanks for all the questions that have come in as well on Facebook and YouTube as well. Any final thoughts, Tom, that you'd like to leave us with as we close out our discussion?
I was fascinated by what Douglas just said about the Transfiguration. I have been on one or two mountains which claim to be the site of the Transfiguration, Mount Hermon, Mount Tabor, etc. Yeah. For me, one of the most moving moments in my life was on Good Friday 1989, when for the first time I went into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and spent most of the day there just contemplating, this is where it happened. And when you're actually there, it doesn't seem odd that the hopes and fears of all the years, or if you like, the pain and tears of all the years, should be focused on one place. And I intuited that, I felt it, and I thought it theologically. And in a sense, that was, it didn't teach me anything I didn't sort of vaguely know already. But the concreteness of it is so striking there. It's not just an idea in people's heads going around the world. This is stuff that actually happened, as a result of which the world is a different place. The world is claimed by God in his kingdom as a result of those facts.
And you see people, we gather the physicality, the story, sort of Machu Picchu's book where, I'll never get this right. We assemble it as people, the story and the physical, and we take story and we make them physical, and we take physical and we use them in story. We're the intermediary there. So
as we close, it reminds me of something you said of the last time you came on the show, Douglas, that you had an experience at Galilee where it made you feel something happened here, was the way you put it.
Yes, yeah. I think that's right. Yes. Yeah. I think it's very hard to come away from there without thinking that.
Thank you so much.
Justin, so you're saying there's a chance?
For tonight's conversation, it's been a real joy and a pleasure. I wish we could have gone on longer, but our time is...
And why couldn't you have?
Perhaps we can do it again at some point in the future. But for now, thank you very much. Douglas Murray and...
And then he'll go off and talk about the stuff that's coming. So there's a question and answer. I do these commentaries, and at the end of it, sometimes I think, well, anybody watch this? Is there any value to it? I guess there is. Y'all tell me there is, so I'll keep doing them. And I like doing them because they're a value to me. Because again, I'm so ADHD, it forces me to sit down and to listen carefully and to grow with them. So, well, there it is. Hope you enjoyed it. Let me know what you have to say in the comments section. Your comments, are very helpful to me. And so I appreciate. Thank you for your time and attention.